This is the beginning of part 6 of the Art Hamill teleseminar.
Okay, we're on to the next section, running the business, absentee owner, management team, exit strategy, etc.
Art, for businesses where you hire a key person to run it in your absentee ownership, how would you go about structuring an arrangement to give him or her an equity stake to incentivize them?
Very good point. We always are setting up incentive programs. Being an industrial engineer, that's probably something that was drummed in my head from day one, incentive programs. And what happens when you win? First of all, I just want to tell you, the first thing you have to be aware of is a certain percent of the time the seller is going to stay around, so you're not going to be hiring another manager. The key thing on that is you can cash the owner out for 100%, but if the owner's going to stay around and manage, the owner's going to expect an incentive program also. So you'll have paid them all cash on Tuesday at the escrow. On Wednesday, when you're sitting down talking about them continuing to run the company, and they've done it to me every time. In the beginning, I screwed up more deals. You couldn't believe it. And they'll say, okay, how about 10% in the stock? So I just bought 100% from them. 1 hour later, I'm buying back 10. So what we do today, if the owner's going to stay on beyond just a few months, we set up an incentive program. And the simple one is we let them keep usually 10% of the stock. We had a couple last year that were 15%, but it's normally 10%. And they don't mind doing that, and then we buy them out later. Now, other than that, when we get in there, we're going to have a manager in place. And what you have to do before you disturb anything, because if you're going to keep on the manager, and I assume you are after you take over, because this other person's been running the company for a year or two for the seller, what you're going to do is find out what their incentive program is, because you don't want to go in with an incentive program and find out that you're below what the person was getting before. So find out all the details of that. And keep in mind, you're going to have to get this from the seller, because the seller is not going to let you sit down and talk to the manager of the company before you buy it. And this is the problem as you get down close to the end. Say, how do I put this thing together? I mean, how do I provide the manager with a contract if the seller won't let me talk to the manager until we close? Hello? You have a problem that is very tough to solve. We've had some where we've been able to sit down with a manager ahead of time and set up the management contract, and we've had some we've had to wait until after we close, or the seller's going to have to decide what it's going to be. But again, don't let either one of them goof you up. Now, if they already have an existing incentive program, look at that and see what you can do to improve it. Because what you're trying to do is, if the company's making X number of dollars a year now with this manager, and your plan is to make this much more, what is it going to cost you? How much can you give him to get him from point A? And let's say he's been increasing the business at 10% a year, and you'd like the percentage to go up to 20%. You just sit down and basically work it backwards. What is the additional profit you're going to get? And what you're basically going to do is build a program in, but you give him a percent of the increased profit. Hey, you don't want to give him part of the profit you're getting now. I mean, that's what you just purchased. And the incentive is going to be based on getting a percent of the increased profit. And again, sometimes we structure it. They're going to get 4% of the first million. They're going to get 3% of the second million. Whatever you decide to set up, and basically you're working backwards. In other words, how much money is it going to take me to get this person to be motivated? It's going to cost me another $1,000 a year, $5,000, $10,000, whatever it is. So I go to that point and then work it backwards to figure out how I'm going to come back to the manager. Again, it isn't something I discuss with the manager. It's something I sit down and discuss with somebody that's in business with me in some other business, or I sit down and talk to the wall or my dog while I'm doing this. But the thing is, put the plan together, bounce it off the manager before you do it in writing, and then come back and give them the agreement in writing with a management contract. Again, we always go to management contracts because we want to be able to keep the employee as long as possible.
What are some of the key metrics that you monitor to keep your finger on the pulse of the absentee ownership business that you have owned?
Okay, it goes back. I remember back in the days, it used to be faxes. Today, what we do is we get emails every day from every business. And what we're doing is we have certain key information we want, like maybe the sales for the day. They don't know the profit or any major expenses over 15 cents. They go on that line. So we're getting that daily. We're then getting a report weekly, which is a summary of that week. Now, most companies have a summary for the week, so it's no big deal to do that. It's also no big deal to give you a daily. Once you get beyond that, the key thing is going to be the monthly reports that you want. And what I do is I keep these on the board up there. And what I do is I have a clipboard, and I actually have them on the wall, okay, in the office. And I can actually flip through those after I've had that business for a while. I can flip through with my finger, and numbers will pop up in my eye, and I'll be able to spot things that are out of line. If the number of new customers every day was 43, and I'm flipping through it, I'll notice that one day was 6, or whatever it happened to be, whatever the number happened to be. Again, they're then providing us, a CPA or the accountant for us, is providing the most important one, which is the monthly. If we're absentee, we have outside companies providing us with a monthly. We have the outside companies providing us with a quarterly and the annually, because we don't trust anyone. Excuse me, Mom. I always tell people, what I always do at the company is I have Mom running the company, then I have my father checking on my mother, and I'm there watching both of them.
What are some controls and methods you use to avoid being ripped off or scammed by the managers of your absentee ownership businesses?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to have at least two people signing checks. Now, keep in mind when you do this, if you have a husband and wife working for you, you don't want to have the husband and wife signing checks, the two of them signing it. If I'm absentee, I normally have the accounting company, the CPA company that I'm working with, that sign the checks, along with the people in the company. And then normally, we're trying to do this on things maybe over $1,000 or something like that. On the small items, we're trying to use things like petty cash, so we're not running checks. But then you have to control the petty cash because they will steal the petty cash. So you have to keep that fund down to nothing and make sure that you have control. In other words, that'll be included in the report that you get daily. What the cash fund is and what it was at the beginning of the day was $1,000 and you started, it's now $2. What happened to the other money? You have to find out as soon as possible. But the key thing is having two people sign checks. The other thing is when you have an accounting firm coming in or a CPA firm, especially that's who we want. We don't want an accounting firm. The CPA firm is going to set up controls in this business, normal accounting controls. And you're going to find those will do a very good job as long as you have somebody monitoring those. Again, you're going to have an accounting firm outside that's going to be doing part of it. You then have to do it yourself on a daily basis with the reports you're getting. And then when you have something that looks out of line, you call a manager on the phone. He gets nervous as hell. You strap on your six gun. You go see him. But we've had very few people that get by and steal very much money from us over the years. I also put the fear of death in them.
What do you say to them?
No problem with what I'm about to say. Because a dentist in Glendale actually went out and copyrighted this and was selling this. It was called the Arthur Hamill drag rope.
Oh, it's a drag rope, tell me.
For years, I would teach this in a class. So since 100,000 people heard this, I might as well tell you what it is. If you remember John Wayne in the Westerns, what would happen is when an officer was caught being trader or something like that. They would take him out into the parade ground, and there'd be some guy out there with a drum going boom, boom, and the officer would be at attention. The commanding officer then would come out with his sword. He'd draw his sword out with his officer standing out in front of him. You know, the flag would be flying. The drummer would be going boom, boom. He would then take the sword and cut off the epaulettes first. He would then cut off the buttons. And then when you get down to the last button, I did something different that they didn't do in the John Wayne movies. I would cut below the last button, and that employee would never steal again. So this dentist came up with the Arthur Hamill drag rope. So what happens is when you find somebody cheating, what you do is you get the Arthur Hamill drag rope out, and you check to see how much you lost. You then tie one end of the rope to the leg of the employee. You tie the other end of the thing to the back bumper of your car. You then go into the Merchant of Venice. If you remember the Merchant of Venice, it's a pound of flesh for every so many dollars. The Merchant of Venice is a pound of flesh. So for every $1,000, we take off so many pounds of flesh. How do we determine that? We get in the car, start the engine, and drive. Now, the employee is going to be dragging along back. It'll be bouncing. What you have to do is make sure that you only stop once the pound of flesh has been removed from the employee. When I used to tell this in the class, either version of that, I could see everybody getting nervous because they were thinking about the stamps they were stealing from their boss, the stuff that employees all work away with. I mean, have you ever searched your employees when they're leaving? Including your mother, you have to watch mom. I hope your mother doesn't work for you.
No, she doesn't. You got to let them know you mean business.
They get nervous. Every company I've ever had, I tell stories like that. And the reason for it is they remember. If I just told them something, it would pass right over. In fact, I can go back to people who went to my class 20, 30 years ago, and they will recite word for word exactly what I said on these stories. And that's why we tell a lot of stories. Again, all of them happen. They all happen. What happens is if you teach for a few years, you tend to embellish a little on. Because they're not as funny as you thought they were.
Okay, next question. Art, did you always have an exit strategy plan for every business before you bought it?
Never. It's just like people ask me, if every time we buy a business, or every time we're doing well, do I redo my financial statement? No. You see, what people do is when they're very young, they put together their first deal, and then they put together a financial statement showing themselves how well they've done. And then what happens is by the time they're in business for a couple of years, they don't ever do that anymore. They're not even thinking about that. Now, as far as an exit strategy, I have never had an exit strategy before or even in the beginning when I bought a business. If I have investors, the investors want to be out in 5 years. So they have an exit strategy. Maybe sooner, but normally 5 years. At the end of 5 year period, I can have an exit strategy too, and I can say, okay, I'm going to get out. But I have never done that. What I do is at the end of 5 years, I still want to own this company. So what we do is we get an appraisal on the company. We give the investor their money back. We then give them a return based on the increased value of the company. So they get some of the upside, and that's determined by the appraisal. Now, for those of you selling your company at that time, you have no problem. You're just giving them a percentage of the increased value of the company. But again, that's our basic exit strategy. Now, even though we're telling our investors, basically, I shouldn't be letting this out, but I'm sure most people know this now. At the end of 5 years, a lot of times what we're going to do is we will have an exit strategy. Let's say it's a company that has a proprietary product. If we have a proprietary product, we may want to be out at the end of 5 years. Now, a lot of people will say, when we get to 5 years, we're going to go public with this company. Well, I don't like these people that are talking to these companies. I had enough trouble years ago when we were in the franchise business. So what we do is if we had a proprietary product, we may approach Procter & Gamble or some other company, depending on what our product is, and try to exchange stock. Because let's say we buy it for a certain multiple, and if the company's worth 2 to 3 times what we paid for it at the end of 5 years. That multiple is great, but the thing is, if we then go to a public company, and if we can exchange our company for stock in their company, we're going to end up getting a multiple that is much larger, which satisfies us as owners. It also satisfies the investors because they get a return far in excess of what they got, and that's always good.
Okay, great. All right, what percentage of cash flow should remain for me after I pay for investors, debt, and other financing costs, 20 to 30%, 40 to 60%? What would be the minimum percent you would recommend never going below?
Okay, well, don't think about it from the standpoint of how much you're going to pull out. What you have to realize, if you get down in the area of 5 and 10% net profit in business, the problem is you're in the grocery store business, or you're in some other business that has very small margins. And if you have a small bump in the economy, or in the business that you have, you're going to be in the red. So you're looking for the ones that have the most profit margin. Now, from the other standpoint, you have to determine how much money you want to make. Now, if my goal is to make $500,000 a year, that means I want to make $500,000 after I've paid everything, after my manager has been paid, not after taxes. Because we're not even taking taxes into consideration because we have an S corporation or a LLC, which is basically like a partnership. So we're thinking about it from that standpoint. I want to be able to pocket $500,000. Am I going to have to pay tax on it? Is my ex-wife going to get part of it? Forget about that. How much money do you want to make on that business, $500,000? And if that's what the business is making now, you're right where you want to be. Then you have to decide how much more you want to make. And what you're going to do is increase it 10, 20%, whatever it happens to be every year. And that's a different thing. But again, for those of you who wonder, say, well, maybe I want to have $100,000 because I can live on $100,000. Well, if you're going to buy a business, let's say you're making $100,000 a year now. In the area I live in, $100,000 isn't very much. You can't even afford a house. In Orange County, again, this was before the big crash of the houses, but I had read that you had to have an income of $171,000 to buy an average house here, which is ridiculous, but I'm sure it's $7,000 now. I don't have any idea. We don't have a loan on our house or anything, so this is what you get when you get very old.
All right, when you buy a company, how do you ensure that management's behind you in supporting your long-term goals?
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be laughing. That is a very good question. It's another thing to worry about, but what you have to do is worry about the way you treat people. Now, if you buy an existing company and you leave the management in place and you're not in there, that's fantastic because I keep telling you, the thing that screws up more existing larger companies are the buyers when they come in. You screw them up royally because you're going to go in and make changes. Well, if you buy a company that's making $500,000 a year now, or $1 million, or $100,000, whatever it happens to be, if you're satisfied with the company and what it's making right now, and the manager's been running it, say, for 4 or 5 years, why would you want to go in and make changes? Now, you might go in and start thinking about things of increasing profit and stuff without driving your manager nuts. Do not go in there. Do not pay a pain in the butt. Don't start making changes. Because once you do that, you're going to screw up the company.
You also have said, though, in other instances, that you're going to have to be at that company for a certain amount of time, but there is a real difference when you're buying a business with an established long-term management team in place. You really can do that eventually. Maybe not the first couple weeks, but that is realistic.
Yeah, you can work your way in. You can do the same thing if you're taking over, but even when you're taking over a company that's existing, say there's an owner, owners that have been running it, they're going to be staying around. We may phase out one owner over 3 or 4 months. We may phase the second owner out over a year. So if you're in there and you're going to be the one running it, there's no problem with transition. You're going to be getting to know everybody. You're not going to be in there being the smart guy running the company. You're going to let the existing owner continue to run the company. You're going to work in there gradually.
That's probably a good thing also to settle the fears of the employees and the management that the owner's going to be around for a while. He's not leaving.
Yep. And also that you're a nice person, you're not going to fire everybody. Because that's another thing that every seller worries about. That you're going to go in and start chopping heads. So during the 5 hours that we're talking to people, we are reassuring them that we don't do that. Unless we catch somebody stealing, and then we're going to fire them.
Okay. What are the main instruments, incentives that you use to do this? Is it mainly financial incentives and target setting, or also motivational psychology in relationship to the managers?
I've always been one of those guys that's into the dollars, giving them money. Now, I'm not saying we don't give them other incentives. We don't say to them, okay, we have restaurants. So when you become a general manager, in other words, when you're over 5 to 8 restaurants, this is a true story, we're going to give you a Buick Riviera. I mean, this is back in the old days when Buick Riviera was a good car. Our managers had Buick Rivieras. The next one, once you became a general manager over 5 to 8 units, you got a Cadillac. We never went beyond that because the people above that were making so much money that we had nothing to do with buying their cars for them. The car used to always be an incentive. Again, it still is today. Everybody's getting an insurance policy. Everybody is getting medical. I mean, we don't have companies where we don't give the employees medical. Even back as medical became more expensive, in all the companies I've ever owned, we have never had the employees have to pay part of medical, even if it meant that was going to cut part of our profit down, because we didn't think it was fair. It would also be distracting. But what you have to do is stay away from the negative incentives. Well, you have to keep a positive attitude, be cool, be nice. In other words, don't change the way you are now just because you own a company.
Okay, great. Are many successful businesses seem to depend upon the strong personality or vision of the founder or current CEO? What's the best way to ensure continuity of that vision or energy after the purchase?
Okay, well, keep in mind, most of you that are listening to this are not going to be buying a company that's going to be at large where you have to worry about vision or things like that. Everybody refers back to this because we're talking about large companies, the multinationals, things along that line. People always ask me, you know, how am I going to be able to see the marketing? How am I going to be able to see the whole marketplace with no experience? I keep saying to them, in all the years I've had that I've been in business, this has never come up. Things like this and questions like this come up from people who haven't been in business before. Once you get into business, 99.9% of the questions you've ever had about business will go away. You'll find the questions that you're normally thinking about before you buy a company fade because they don't pertain anymore. It's something that you think about before you buy a business. But once you buy a business, you don't ever think about that anymore. It's something that you read about in a scholar's study, but the rest of us out there working our butt off running these companies don't think about that.
Okay. How do I know if the management team in place is correct or if I need to replace it?
Well, if you get in there and you buy a company that's making the amount of money that you like, and let's say you want a company making $500,000, and it's making $500,000 a year, and it's been increasing in sales and profit every year for the last 3 or 4 years, you ought to give your management team a hug, even if they're the ugliest people in the world, because the profit is going to tell you. And again, we don't want you buying businesses that are turnarounds. Because in that case, you may have to fire all your managers. But when you're buying a good company, even if some are ugly, even if some of them are weak, overall, your company is making the profit that you're satisfied with. If you then, over the next few months, want to go in there and you're analyzing the managers and you find some of them weak and you want to replace them, that's fine. But in the beginning, be satisfied with what you have. Don't get nervous about it, because if you don't do anything, it'll continue going along, right? So you don't tell them, my God, we may have weak managers. Well, even if you don't come back from Tahiti for a year, the weak manager will still be there and the company will still be going ahead. And then after you get in there, or after a few weeks or a few months, you can get in there and make the changes. But in the beginning, keep in mind, when you're buying good companies and they haven't been up and down and things like this, you don't want to go in there with a mindset that you're going to change things. You don't want to do that because you're going to screw up your company.
Okay, this question kind of relates. Once you've purchased a business, what should you focus on to create a more lucrative business than what you bought so that you can sell it at even a higher profit?
Well, first of all, I never think about it. I'm not in the business of flipping businesses. So since I plan on keeping them, not forever, but whatever forever means. And a normal person does not go in there thinking about they're going to buy this business and then build the thing up. Now, are we going to build it up just for the sake of building it up? Yes, because that's what we want to do. I mean, why be in business if you're not going to increase profit? And so what happens is, if I'm working as an absentee owner, there's somebody else running the company, that business is going to be run by that person day in and day out. All the problems that you have every day, in fact, the thing that drives everybody nuts in business and they don't even think about it, is the day-to-day crap that you run into. Once you get to the point where you have somebody managing it, you're basically managing them from a distance, or even if you're only 2 feet away, what's going to happen is your life changes. Again, it's the day-to-day crap that you run into running a business that drives you nuts. Once you get away from that, the whole thing changes. I mean, people have come to me over the years that I can't believe this. I've been running these companies on my own. All of a sudden, I've backed off, and my whole life has changed. Of course it has, because it's the day-to-day crap that drives you nuts.
Okay, one more for this section. Art, I heard a recording of an interview you did with Michael Self where you said that just hire people to run the business you buy. How could an employee possibly be trusted to run the business properly?
Well, first of all, we buy businesses, there's usually managers in place. A lot of times we get the owner to stay. Now, if I'm buying a business and there's not a manager there and the owner's leaving in a short period of time, once I go in the due diligence period, which is a 60-day period, once I have a letter of intent signed, even before the contract, I start looking for managers. I interview them. I do all of this. I want to hit the ground running, as we say. In other words, I want to have that manager hired in place when we take over the business so that the former owner or owners can help train this manager. Even though he's fantastic running this type of company, we now have somebody with experience that's going to run this company. He's going to be paid well. He's going to have the opportunity to run a company. But again, he'll have also the benefit of the owner staying around for a period of time. Now, this is maybe 40, 30 hours a week. And then after that, with most owners, we have them on as consultants for the next couple of years so that we can bring them in an hour at a time. In other words, we don't leave anything to chance. Whatever thing that you're bringing up or I bring up when I'm going to buy a business, I correct. I don't let it just sit there. And again, all the things that all of you bring up are very important, but what's going to happen is once you get into business, most of the things disappear.
We're now into section specific questions for Art and his methodology. Art, what is your profit formula? Down payment, going in, cash flow, and timing your sale.
Okay, timing the sale is as soon as possible. Normally, we're going in to buy a company. We're talking about closing maybe in 3 months or 4 months. We are normally asking for a 60-day due diligence period. It also takes a time. In other words, we're going to go in there. We're going to be negotiating for two or three, four meetings before we go to letter of intent. So maybe that's a week or two. And then we're going through a 60-day due diligence period. Then you normally have another period from contract to close. So you're talking about 3 months, maybe 4 months, as far as the close. The down payment is as little as possible. If we're going in to buy a business and we're bringing investors in, again, we're going to bring investors in for the whole thing. So we don't really have a down payment formula. When we're going in and we're working with, say, a manufacturing company, we have been the experts in leverage buyout, and that's what we have done for years. Even for the last few years we've had investors, we've done a lot of leverage buyout. Leverage buyout is nothing more than getting the owner to provide financing, maybe 30-40%, and then financing the assets for the rest of it. And if you buy the business at the right price, and I don't mean magic price, I mean market price, and we get owner financing, normally we can finance the assets and the owner financing and cover 100% of the cost of buying the company. Now, that is not nothing down. That's 100% financing. And what will happen is the magic numbers will come up to 50%. If we're bringing investors in, we're giving out 50% of the cash flow. If we're going in and getting owner financing, and if we're also getting asset financing on a manufacturing company, we're normally giving out 50% again. Now, this is not a magic formula. This is how the arithmetic works out. It has been for years. In fact, I don't care where I work on a planet, when they're doing a leverage buyout in England, or they're doing it in New Zealand, or they're doing it in Australia, it usually goes up to about 50%.
All right, I've heard that it's best to own a business in a field that one is very passionate about. Does this also apply when one is buying a business using your methodology?
Okay, well, I don't know about that. I have never been passionate about any company I've ever owned. What I've been passionate about is making a certain profit and keeping the profit going up, and that's been my passion. But if somebody came along and offered me a good price for some business I owned, I would sell it. I wouldn't even worry about it. So there's not the passion there. And again, passion is something that you read about or hear about, these people in the electronics industry or the people that got into the internet sites. But when you meet them and talk to them, there may be a passion there before they do it, or even when they're starting and getting this going. But I've met a lot of these people over the years since I used to live in San Jose, California, and owned a few companies up there. And all I can tell you is I don't see the passion that you're talking about. Again, I see the passion for running the company and things like that, but they're usually pretty cool people. What you have to do is do find something you like. If you have a job right now, there's a good chance that you hate your boss, number one. Number two, you hate the business you're in. So when you go out to look for a business, do not start with a business you're in. You say, well, I have experience in this. That's fine. That's going to be great. Now, if you go out and try to get a loan from the Small Business Administration and you don't have experience in that business unless you fudge it, they're not going to guarantee the loan on the thing. Now, if you're going out to buy a business from someone else, say from an existing owner, on a business like that, and you're getting owner financing, and you're getting bank financing, stuff like that, you don't have the same thing coming up.
Greetings. I purchased your seminar in cassette form that was recorded in the 70s. Is that information still applicable today?
You know, I talked to people about this. I even talked to it back in the days when the seminar business. The people always say to me, have you updated it? Have you changed things? I said, well, you know, in the beginning, we put it together. We had a tax section in it, which changed all the time, the income tax. We then took that out, and since then, nothing has changed. I always tell people, I said, if you're ever in California or any other state, and I'm working on a business deal, and you'd like to come in a meeting and keep your mouth shut, you'll notice that we do the same thing today that we were doing 50-some years ago. There is one way of doing it that works all the time, okay? This is the way we do it. If there's other people out there doing it some different way, I'm not even aware of that because we've been in our own little area for all these years. All I'm saying is if you do it our way or the way we're suggesting, you're going to find it works. And there's no magic to it. It's a nice, very simple thing. But the key thing is we have not had to change it. It hasn't changed. We do the same thing over and over again. Now, if somebody would come up with something different or something that worked a lot better, we'd do it. But that hasn't happened.
All right. How relevant is the information you provide to be able to buy a business in a country other than the USA?
I have been working with people all over the planet for years, and I haven't had any of them come back and tell me how something is different. When I see speeches all the time, I say, look, I don't care where you try to put a business deal together. This is the way you do it. I don't care what country you're in. And if you go to Mars, I'm sure it's the same way. I said, why is it the same on a different planet? I mean, how many ways can you do something? I mean, we have one way of doing it, okay? We're buying a business. We do it a certain way. It works every time. Are there other variations that you can use? Probably. Why don't we use them? Why make it more complicated? Why get a headache doing this? Besides, we may have even done some things differently 53 years ago, but ever since we've been in the seminar business, I'd say 40-some years ago. And I hate to tell you, we started that many years ago, especially since I'm 37 now.
That's right, Art. You're young. All right, Art, would you ever buy a business if they did not have a list of customers or clients to give you?
Okay, the customer list or a client list, whatever you want to call it. The key thing that's always a problem with new people buying a business, they want the customer list that they can check out before they close. It's not going to happen. Should you be able to check with customers and make sure everything's real? Yes. Will I give you a customer list before you close? You do realize when you go to the customers what you're going to do to the business plan. You're going to screw it up because the word is going to get out with all the customers. The business is for sale. They're going to be looking for other people they can do business with. The business is going to lose customers and business, and you're probably going to get sued by the seller for screwing up their business. Yes, you should have that customer list before you close. Will you ever get it before you close? You will run into a stupid seller every now and then, but the average business seller is never going to let you do that. And again, once you sell your business, don't let them do it either. And again, it's an either or. You're saying, my God, well, how can we do this? Well, there's a lot of situations that come up in business when you're trying to buy it where you can't go the step you want to go as a buyer because the seller knows that if you do take that step, even if the deal goes together, the deal has just gotten screwed up.
How do you utilize today's technology and online platforms to do your work versus the old days?
Well, first of of all, we didn't have platforms in the old days. The platform we had was the platform out on the loading dock that the trucks backed up to so we could load. Everything's changed today with the Internet. I mean, there's all sorts of companies out there that are expanding their business at a fantastic rate, faster than they ever did before, because of the ability to advertise the product or have a website that sells a lot of their products. And you also have to have people on the payroll or people you hire that do that. I mean, in the old days, we didn't have people working for us that were in TI or things like that. Business was not that complicated, but it has gotten more complicated today. But even for a person like myself, when I owned a business and we've had websites, believe me, I had nothing to do with putting those together. I could barely get to them. But again, I was still able to run these companies effectively without that knowledge. But again, everything has changed now, including the term. That's why I was making a joke out of the platform thing, because there's a lot of technology that the young people use that is a lot different than it used to be. Not that it's not better.
Okay. Wait, Art, do you have any suggestions on how to persuade one's wife that buying a business is not a crazy, off-the-wall idea?
Excuse me. You know, if it's not your wife, it's going to be your brother-in-law, or it's going to be your mother, your father. I don't remember ever talking to anybody that didn't get a lot of harassment from wives, brother-in-laws, mothers, fathers, telling them not to do it. They're a bum. You'll never make it. You can't make it in business. You don't have the following. I mean, I can't remember how many people told me over the years. I mean, I've had this happen a number of times as I've had different stages and size of businesses that I couldn't do it. We always did it. Of course, I never went back and tried to correct them on it. The thing that's interesting, mom and dad are going to give you a hard time. Your wife's going to give you a hard time. Once you get into that business and you're making all that money, that name, they call you a bum, your wife calls you a bum, or you're never going to make it. Your mom calls you that. As soon as you start to make the money, they're going to hug you and tell you that they told you all along you could make it, including your wife. And again, you're going to say, well, my wife wouldn't do that. Well, you buy that business and start making that money, and she gets to go out and spend it. And she will never even remember telling you that you couldn't do it. Does everybody run into this problem? Yes, sir. Young people that don't run into problems with the wife are the ones that aren't married yet. So for those of you that are waiting to get married, wait.
That's funny. Okay, Art, what deal was your most profitable, and how did you determine it?
Any business that you want to make the most money, the least investment is going to be a service business. One of the businesses that we made a lot of money in was the seminar business over the 15-year period. But you see, we were in a number of other businesses. I don't even know how many companies we had at the time. We owned a lot of businesses that we were buying. But at the same time we were in the seminar business, we had 5 business brokerage offices. We had 2 or 3 merger and acquisition offices. We had 2 or 3 finance company offices. We had 2 consulting company offices. These are all support organizations. How many people did we have all together? Hundreds of them. How much did we make? We made millions of dollars. How much? All I can remember was all the things we were going through at the end of the year, trying to cut down on the taxes we were paying. And if you talk to my CPAs, I'm sure they can tell you all the fun we had trying to do that. Of all these things that were coming along, I mean, I think of the windmill projects and the solar panel projects, you know, with all these tax benefits. Did we ever save money on those? I don't have any idea. And some of them I can't talk about on the air. But we paid our taxes, and we also made a lot of money, but I don't know how much, and I don't know what our profit margin was, because it sort of grew like tops. You know, we had people getting out, they couldn't get financing, we had people that couldn't find businesses. So we basically, since we had so many people going through our program, we just went into the business and figured, if nobody else will do it, we'll do it for ourselves.
Have you bought any art galleries? And have you seen any art gallery financials you can share with me?
Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time working with a good friend of mine up in Carmel, California, who has the largest Henry Miller collection in the United States. And he has art galleries there. The last time I talked to him was in that area. He had either 6 or 7 art galleries. So I was very familiar with the financials on them. I was also very familiar with what we were working on doing on these things and how we were marketing these, because he had something like $20 million worth of art, Henry Miller, which is pretty good stuff. In fact, I think we have 3 or 4 of them on my wall here at my home. And again, at that time, those things were going for, what, $4,000 or $5,000 each. They're probably up to $10,000 or $15,000 now. Quite an artist.
Was he selling them through his gallery?
No, he didn't sell just that through his galleries. If you went to the Henry Miller galleries, if you're up in Carmel or you're out of Pebble Beach, they have a big one out of Pebble Beach, and there's one in Carmel, there's one in Monterey, there's 3 of them down in Big Sur. They're all over the place. And that's just one thing he handles.
What kind of margins are there on that?
Henry Miller, I had no idea, because this was privileged information that he had. I know what he sold it for, but I did not know what his cost basis was.
So he had an arrangement with the artist?
Henry Miller lived in Carmel. Gary was a good friend of his when he was still alive, so he got the right to take it over. And he has the biggest collection in the U.S., and then the biggest collection outside the U.S. for Henry Miller is in Japan. But I have experience doing that. Have I owned an art gallery? Never. No, I know nothing about that. But I was able to help Gary working with him.
Very good. How much money does one need in order to pursue buying a business with investor money? For example, money allocated for travel, etc., to meet the seller, business plan writing fees, CPA attorney fees, fees to pay Art's hourly consulting fees, and the necessary money to put a skin in the game into the business in order to win over the investors. How much total approximately?
Well, depending on the size of the business, but in the beginning, I always suggest you buy something close because you're going to feel more comfortable, even if you're working absentee. For those of you that buy out of larger companies, I work with a number of people that their first time in buying a large company, say making over $1 million. And a number of them over the years have bought companies all the way across the country on their first deal. Of course, I try to talk them out of that in the beginning because of the cost, because you're flying back and forth and you're spending a lot of time and money out there doing this. I cannot predict what it's going to be because it's going to depend on how close or how far you are. I mean, if you're going to do this locally and you have to drive, you're talking about a few tanks of gas and not staying over or anything like that. But if you're going back to the East Coast, you're talking about thousands of dollars. Now, this is incidental compared to what you're going to have to invest in the business. So again, it's going to depend on the size of the business. It's going to depend on whether you're working with investors. There used to be a lot of deals out there where you'd be putting in very little because the investors would be coming in. Ever since we've had this prime equity fiasco in the United States, a lot of the buyers have become very antsy on that. In other words, they really don't like nothing down or very little down on these. fact, the other example is just say you go out and try to find a business, and you're going to get SBA guaranteed financing. The SBA thing will, I think, will now go up to 90%, so they'll guarantee 90% of the loan. But as I told you, the big problem is, again, it's hard enough to get owners to carry back financing. But if you're trying to get an SBA loan that you tell a seller that they have to keep 10 to 20% because the government tells them they have to, I haven't had this come up yet, but I can imagine how they're going to react to that and that problem. On those, they're going to require 20, 25% down. You're not going to get it with nothing. Again, it's going to depend on where you are in the economy, what your background is. In other words, I'm talking about investors. I'm talking about them getting antsy about ones that don't have money and also don't have experience, because there's three things that I used to always ask people. They come to me and say, okay, I have to ask you three questions. First of all, do you have any business experience? Number two, do you have any management experience? And number three, do you have any money? Now, if you don't have two of these, you're screwed. You're dead. If you don't have money, we can probably do it for very little. As long as you have management experience and you have business experience. But the thing is, if you come in and you have money and you have some business experience and no management experience, you're still going to have problems with it. All I'm saying is you have to think of those three areas they're going to look at. Everybody's going to look at. The government's going to look at. How much business experience do you have? How much experience do you have in management? And the third thing is how much money do you have? You can get around a lot of things, but the biggest problem is trying to get around the money thing. And so it's going to depend on which way you go. Now, if you don't have a lot of money, one of the easiest ways to go, probably easiest, is a leverage buyout. Getting owners to provide financing on this sort of thing, and then financing assets. And again, if you're financing equipment, accounts receivable, and inventory, people usually aren't asking for a financial statement. So you're not running into that. They're not asking for how much down that you're putting in. So on leverage buyout, this doesn't come up very often. With the investors, this did not come up until recently. Does that mean that none of the investors will ever work with anybody with nothing down or very little down? I have no idea until you go out and check it. But again, I think it's really going to depend on, if you don't have a lot of money for the down payment, how much experience do you have in that business? How much management experience do you have? And you have to think about the three.
Okay. Or do you run multiple businesses at one time? If yes, what is the most number of businesses you have had to run simultaneously, and how do you do it?
Okay, first of all, we were in Mexico for 15 years. By the time we got done in Mexico, we had 17 companies in Mexico. We also owned 6 other companies, so at that time we owned 23. I'm trying to give you numbers that I remember. Now, in the beginning, we got involved in the restaurant business. We had that small motel in Modesto, which was a mistake of great proportion. We then got involved with a pizza chain. We built a unit in California. We then took over a number of other ones. We had, at the end of 1 year, I think we had 10 of them, because we had taken over ones that were in trouble. We then had somebody stop by our little dinky, stupid little motel selling franchises. We went into the franchise business. We became involved in a member of Continental Marketing Institute. We sold franchise companies. One of them we took over was one on the East Coast, an hamburger business. It had 12 units. We were having trouble getting them to do anything. We had sold a number of franchises in California. So I bought that company. We had 12. So they gave us 22 restaurants. At the end of 2 years, we had 30 businesses. I don't remember the other ones, but those are the keys. And how did I get involved with so many? I was absolutely insane at that time. How do I know I was insane? Why would anybody that's an engineer that knows manufacturing get involved in restaurants? I mean, you have to be really stupid. Somebody has asked me before today, did I do any stupid things? First thing I did was getting involved in the restaurant business. At that time, I said to myself, let me see, I'm making about $50,000 a unit profit. In order to make $1 million, I need 20 of these. So I'm going to have 20 crazy managers, restaurant managers, not making very much. It dawned on me, I could buy one manufacturing company making $1 million and only have one person reporting to me. And from that point on, we got a manufacturing business. For both of you thinking I just made that up, that's the actual true story.
Okay, great. All right, I got one more question. It's a long one. Before the recent economic collapse, I bought your course and additional consultations from you and put in a great deal of time looking for businesses to buy here in greater Los Angeles area. I did everything exactly as you instructed. I found many businesses available to buy, but none that met your perfect deal criteria. If the business could be had for 4 to 5 times earnings, it had some major flaw that would disqualify it with your investor. And if it had no major flaws, the owners insisted on 7 to 8 times earnings. I possibly could have eventually found the perfect deal, but I couldn't afford to keep putting in the time to search. Along the way, I met other people experienced in buying businesses who told me that the reason I couldn't find the perfect deal was that the market for small businesses had evolved in the last 20 years, and that there's now a lot more money chasing these deals than there was before, resulting in prices being bid up. From your perspective, having bird dogs all over the country, you may still have perfect deals brought to you simply because of the huge volume or searching that's been done by people wanting the backing of your investors or by people who have known you for decades. But for a new person to this game and having to earn a living while looking, doing enough searching to financially stumble over a perfect deal seems unrealistic. Not impossible, mind you, but unrealistic as a practical matter. I'm expecting your initial response to this idea to be something like, well, maybe this isn't for you, or I do have people who are winning with my system. Well, with so many people trying it, someone's bound to get lucky. Don't get me wrong, I'm sure your system works every bit as well as you claim when you developed it many years ago, but you yourself told me that Michael Sinoff's customers hadn't bought you even one qualifying deal. You attributed that to the quality of his customers, but could it be also that the environment your system was designed to handle has changed?
No. Obviously, you have been talking to business brokers, and the relationship I have with business brokers is known far and wide. When you talk about the multiples being 4 and 5, what you're talking about is manufacturing companies, and those are the things we've set up. And again, if you go out in the real world, what you're going to find is that is what these businesses are selling for. Are there ones out there selling for 7 and 8? Yes, there are. But what I can tell you is I have been continually working around the world, and I keep running the same thing, business at 4 and 5 times net. Now, as far as having perfect businesses, the rules that we have for investors are not set up by me. In other words, I didn't set these up and say, okay, investors, we want you to invest $1 million in a business with somebody that has little or no money, and we don't want to have any rules. What happened is over the years we've had investors, and again, they keep changing them. They keep making them tougher and tougher. In the beginning, it was just me working with the investors. They have toughened them up. I don't even know if I qualify anymore. So if they appear to be perfect, it's just that they're putting up $1 million. Over the years, they get more and more nervous, so they ask for more and more things. Now, if you weren't able to do this with us, it's very simple. Go out, find a business, get owners to finance it, get them to carry back 30-40%, which is a normal thing. In fact, your broker friends will also tell you that they can get owner financing. So you get 30 or 40%. And what's going to happen is, if it's a manufacturing company, you can finance the assets. You don't need my help to do that. You can go out and do that on your own. You can do it right now. And although you think that the world is against you again, I don't know what to tell you. All I'm saying is, instead of getting angry about this, what you're going to do is go out and try it again. You don't have to go out and use my help. What you do is go out and try it. Go out and try spending 4 or 5 hours with each seller. First of all, find a business that's priced right. You know, I've been in the business longer than you have, and I know what the price on businesses are. You're working with brokers, obviously, but if you go out in the real world, you're going to find a lot of businesses priced in this level. Again, you're in California, just one business by sell. Go on all the businesses in the category you're looking for and find out what percentage of them are in the category of 7 and 8 times multiple. And you're going to find that if you go back and check with the brokers, they've had those damn listings for 15 years. And that's why the price is so high. Why are there a lot of them on the market that are priced at that level? Because those are the ones that don't sell. Those are also the C corporations that don't sell. What you want to do is find one that's priced in the right category. Also, if you want to try something else from an arithmetic standpoint, take the businesses that the brokers tell you are up there 8 and 9 times the EBITDA and try to put them together arithmetic-wise. Try to make the arithmetic that the broker has set up for you make sense so that after you provide the seller with financing and you also finance assets, how much cash flow do you have left? The arithmetic does not work out. They're also going to tell you that owners normally carry back financing for 5 years. Back in the days when I was teaching, the first thing I always start off was by showing everybody that 5-year financing doesn't work because every time it screws the damn buyer. How do I know that? I don't know. Maybe 8 years on the fraud committee for the Department of Real Estate. I'm sorry you're upset, but what you ought to do, instead of just going through life and being upset with me, take my picture and throw darts at it. At the other side, take yourself and go out just for the heck of it. Even though I'm probably wrong, you can find a business in this category. Take your time. You don't need any help. You already know how to do it. Go out and do this. Get the owner financing. Get a manufacturing company so you can finance assets. Don't go after service and retail. And what's going to happen is you'll find it working. I don't know what else to say.
No, you don't give up. You keep going.
I hate to tell you how many times I have been turned down in deals or how many times I have had rough periods and things haven't worked. And also, off the record, Michael, I can't tell you some of the stuff that I've had problems with people, not from California, but from other parts of the country, where over the whole time I worked with them, they did the same thing after the same thing. And the reason they couldn't make it work is they wouldn't listen. But also, the biggest problem I've had over the years has been the fact that people still get hung up on C-Corps. They want to buy a C-Corp.
All right, what's negative about a C-Corp? Why don't you want a C-Corp? What's the problem with it?
Okay, because you can't buy assets in a C-Corporation. What happens is C-Corporations are taxed twice. They had a thing called the General Utilities Doctrine that was wiped out in 1986 tax reform. And before that, what happened is when you had a C corporation, you have to sell stock. So what happened is, if you try to sell assets, it would tax you on it twice, which is what they're doing today. Now, up until 1986, when you were running the company, you paid tax twice, okay, in C corp. When you were selling your company through 1986, you only had to pay tax once. So when they sold assets, it was no problem. Today, what happens is they pay tax twice. So what happens is the tax on the assets, if you try to sell assets in a C-Corp, the tax comes to 60% of your gain.
60% of your gain?
Yep. Well, that's your tax, 60%. Now, from a buyer's standpoint, the problem is when you buy stock, your liability goes back to day one of the corporation. If you buy assets, your liability starts when you take over.
Can a C-Corp that wants to sell change their corporation status and then sell?
Yeah, over a 10-year period. But what happens is it's then prorated. It's different state to state, but normally it's prorated 10 years. In other words, even if you do it after 5 years, you're going to get some benefit, but you're still going to be hit with a heavy tax.
Your advice would be anyone out there looking at businesses, if it's a C-Corp, just don't even look.
But I have not been very convincing with some people over the years that have spent a lot of time. I mean, they have spent the first year working on C-Corps. If I can't convince them and they want to keep spending the money, that's their problem. But normally what happens with people like this, they run out of money before they get anything.
How did they think that they were going to do it? They were willing to take on the liability, but investors aren't going to touch it.
You can't finance it either. Also, if you have an attorney that has been to law school and been back at all and got more than D's in the class, they would never let you buy a C-Corp. And what happens is, take an example, there's a company that a number of them got stuck on, this large company in Denver, Colorado, and they have lots of listings. A lot of their listings are C-Corps, and the reason they're C-Corps is they can't sell them. So what happens is they put these beautiful packages together. I mean, you'll love the packages they put together. So what happens is when you go to them, they have an ad in the paper or they're on the internet. You go to them, and if they figure you're a flake or if you don't have any money or you don't impress them, they send you one of their old packages. They figure, the hell they have to lose, right? Maybe some stupid person will buy it. I then have to fight with them, the person that you and I are working with, to convince them to back off on the damn thing.
This is the end of part 6 of the Art Hamill Teleseminar. Please continue to part 7.